I rise to solemnly inform the House, in the presence of family and our military chiefs, that the 100th Victoria Cross has been awarded to an Australian. This award is to the late Corporal Cameron Baird, already an iconic figure in our Army, who had earlier received the Medal of Gallantry. As the citation reads, his Victoria Cross is for most conspicuous acts of valour, extreme devotion to duty, and ultimate self-sacrifice at Gorchak Village in Uruzgan Province, Afghanistan, as a commando team leader. He was on his fifth Special Forces tour when he was killed in the action for which he was awarded the Victoria Cross. On the 22nd of June last year, in the first phase of the engagement, Corporal Baird and his team came under heavy fire on three separate occasions from well-prepared enemy positions. In the initial encounter, six enemy combatants were killed and weapons caches were captured. In subsequent encounters, Corporal Baird charged enemy positions and neutralised them with grenade and rifle fire. By drawing fire on himself repeatedly, he enabled other members of his team to regain the initiative. In the second phase of the engagement, Corporal Baird then led an assault on an enemy-held compound. On three separate occasions, under heavy fire, he forced the door of a building. Twice he was forced to withdraw, to reload, and then to clear his rifle. For the third time, he entered the building, again drawing fire away from his comrades, who were able to secure the objective. Tragically, he was killed in this final assault. Madam Speaker, words can hardly do justice to the chaos, confusion and courage that were evident that day. The comrade who was with him testifies, "I have witnessed many acts of leadership and courage under enemy fire during my operational service. Corporal Baird's initiative, fearless tenacity and dedication to duty in the face of the enemy were exemplary and an absolute inspiration to the entire team. I was witness to the ultimate sacrifice." Madam Speaker, I salute Corporal Cameron Baird, VC MG. We all salute him and his almost equally remarkable comrades. In this place, we don't face danger, so we can hardly claim him as our brother, but we do acclaim him as our hero. We can hardly imagine what the likes of Corporal Baird and his comrades go through, but we stand in awe of their extraordinary courage, the extraordinary courage of these amazing men who serve our country and keep us safe.
Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I have two guests on with me. Both are former Australian Army. And we have a special episode for you. I'm on with Brad Watts and Tom Newkirk. Gentlemen, how's it going?
Good morning. Very well.
Yeah, good. Thanks, John. How are you?
I'm good. Just had a post-Thanksgiving leftover meal, which is pretty good. You guys don't have anything like that, right, in Australia?
No.
That's an American holiday, mate, but happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Happy Thanksgiving, John.
All right, so you guys were both in the Voodoo Medics documentary for 2 weeks ago. I recorded with Kristen Shorten and Jody Teach, Christian put together this documentary. She's a journalist in Australia, and her husband is a former Second Commando Regiment guy. And so she put this documentary together. What she said is she wanted to focus on the special operations medics who had dealt with trauma in Afghanistan, or who had seen the most trauma. And at some point throughout the process for getting everything together, she came across the name Voodoo Medics. And then there's a saying that goes with it, and I thought it was pretty cool, the name and the kind of the backstory to it. And so how do you guys get involved in Voodoo Medics?
Well, I'll go first.
Go for Fred.
I'll go first there, John. So Kristen gave us a call. I believe she did the same. I'm not sure who the first person she knew was, but she gave us all a call. She obtained a list of names of people who had served in the two units as Voodoo Medics, and I guess she just started ringing around and seeing who would be interested in participating in her documentary. At first, most of us are probably fairly quiet about our previous lives, and it's a bit confronting to sort of have to put it out there in the media. But as the project moved along, and definitely seeing the final product, it was something pretty cool in the end.
Yeah, same for me. So I still keep in close contact with a lot of the current and ex Voodoo Medics. And they just contacted me to see if I would be interested, having got wind of the the documentary being considered. And I was more than happy to contribute.
Yeah, and Brad, I know you brought it up where, the lives that you guys were leading before, everything was compartmentalized and you have to keep things secret and quiet for security and operational security and stuff like that. So one of the things that I asked Jody when we recorded, and this is something that I know to be true from talking to primarily American veterans, primarily special operations guys, but also infantry guys, is that sometimes when talking about this, or in the case of you guys where you did the documentary, sometimes it's the first time you've spoken about some of these incidents since you've gotten out. And I know that can be difficult, but guys have told me that after speaking about it, they've felt better. Has that been your experience?
Yeah, I guess for me, this is the first time I've probably publicly put most of that information out there. And the only people I'd spoken to about any of these incidents all those times were other guys who were either there or had been there or were likely to go there. So, when Kristen first asked to be a part of it, I wasn't sure whether the public would actually really be that interested in what we did. And then I guess for me, it was more the message that Kristen was trying to get across around resilience. And, you can go through these incredibly hard but also incredibly fun times and come through okay. And so for me, that was important to be a part of that, because I'm a huge believer in what Kristen was trying to do there.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. I knew that the intent of Kristen was extremely positive, and I looked at it as if I could share my experiences in a way that might even help just one person to either be prepared for deployment or cope whilst deploying or post-deployment, then that was going to be worthwhile. And so, I jumped on the opportunity.
Yeah, I think a lot of guys listen, people who are either considering signing up or people who are already in and maybe considering going to selection for a specialized unit, or somebody who was in combat and infantry or special operations and they got out, and then maybe they're struggling in some way. And I mean, everybody struggles, military or civilian or whatever, but and I think when guys can see that other members of that, for that brotherhood have gone through something and they've overcome that, or, it helps them out and they say, all right, this is normal to perhaps feel this way, and it's something that I can overcome,
Absolutely.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's a good brotherhood, like you say.
So if we can kind of, you know, take turns, guys, and go through your life before you joined the Army and kind of what kind of encouraged you to join, and then if we can, like, walk through your careers a little bit, if you guys want to take turns.
You want to kick off, Tommy?
Yeah, sure. Before I joined the Army, I was a butcher straight out of high school. So I did my apprenticeship in butchery and moved around a couple of different butcher shops. And at the time, I was just living with my dad. As my parents had split, my brother had moved out. I got one older brother. So I was just living with my dad and doing my apprenticeship. And my dad's an ex-US citizen who came out to Australia. He was conscripted in 66, I think, for Vietnam, and then got assigned to 101st Airborne. So got a Yankee military background. And nice. So he always used to talk about his conscription and what he did. His brother was conscripted at the same time. And I've got a lot of other military family members, like my grandmother on my mum's side was a nurse for the English Army, and her husband, my grandfather, he jumped around in a couple of different armies too. He was Ukrainian, Hong Kong police, in the Gurkhas, and then finally in the Australian Army. So nice. Yeah, it's always been there. So I was pretty keen to sign up and did so at 26, always wanting to be a medic. It always just appealed to me. My dad told me never to jump out of planes, and he also told me never to join up, so you never really listen. But I did listen to the part not to jump out of planes initially anyway, so I went straight for medics, being intrigued by being responsible for that guy on the ground and, you know, being having that pressure and the responsibility to, you know, look after the guys that you're in tune with and you know very well. That really appealed to me. I bumped around a couple of hospital units after completing basic training and my medics course, and met my now wife on my medics course as well. So that was another good thing that came from my service.
Nice. Is she a veteran as well?
Yeah, she's deployed to Indonesia doing humanitarian aid and that sort of stuff. So she's nice. Returned service person as well. Yep. After that, I got offered to come into the Special Operations, into 2nd Commando Regiment, did that, and then was extremely impressed and motivated by the professionalism comparatively. So it just drove me forward, and then meeting the fraternity of the Voodoo Medics, they're all looking after each other before and after, and it was absolutely absolutely eye opening how professional and how in tune with each other they were, and it was just amazing. It was excellent. Deploying to Afghanistan with 2nd Commando Regiment, and then moving into the Special Operations Engineer Regiment when I got back from my deployment. And having had that experience, the Engineer Regiment wasn't didn't have a lot of history. It wasn't very old. It was only about 7 or 8 years old when I got put in there. So coming from the 2nd Commando, wasn't long before I was heading up, you know, like a medical retrieval team for a CBR element within that regiment.
Mean to cut you off, but
sure.
So the special operations, the engineers, that's a more recently created unit. And can we just talk about that a little bit? It's not something that I've heard of often or, sure. or talked about much.
Yep. So they're predominantly made of engineers, combat engineers mostly, and focus a lot on, device detection and, you know, EOD techs and that sort of stuff, as well as having a dog capability. Decom facility and big CBR element, and they play a lot with the emergency services like the fire department, and walk through dirty zones and possible CBR NE threats as well. So it's the regiment was always there. They went through a couple of name changes and a couple of scope changes where they had to focus specifically on a couple of different things, and then they got really recognized, and they took right off.
And you finished up with the engineers, right?
Yeah, I finished up full-time with the engineers, and then I did some reserve time for about 18 months after that, just for a rehabilitation platoon, helping junior soldiers that had injured themselves in their initial training. And from there, I left defense and went to work in corrective services as a prison guard.
Okay, nice. And, yep. And oh, cool. Awesome. So, and then Brad, if you can walk through your life right before the Army and then through the Army as well.
Yeah, no problems, John. I joined the Army as a 17-year-old straight out of high school. I'd always wanted to join the Army, or the idea first came in year 12 as I was sort of thinking about what I was going to do. I wanted to become a paramedic, but at 17 I approached the paramedic service and they said, go away and get a few years' experience. I lived in a small town called Darwin at that point in time, and the Army had moved in, and it looked like a pretty cool job. And so I wanted to get out of Darwin. I wanted to, you know, go and experience life a little bit more. And so that, you know, I lived in a fairly low socioeconomic area. In fact, the judge was quoted as, instead of building a second jail in Darwin, they should just fence off Cornwall Circuit. That was my home for 15 years. So I grew up in a pretty cool place and with some really cool experiences. And so yeah, as I was moving through year 12, I indicated to my teachers and my parents I was going to join the Army. And my teachers held an intervention. They pulled me in and said, look, you know, brought my mum in and sat me down and said, you know, you're going to waste your life. Joining the Army is the last resort and all these sorts of things. So they their plan was for me to go to university. So nothing cemented my decision more. And I, that afternoon, walked down to recruiting and signed up. And, the best decision of my life by far. And 4 weeks later, 2 weeks after I finished my year 12 exams, I joined as a medic into the Army. Like Tomo, I wanted to be a medic 100%. That was all I wanted to do. And so I started the training, 2 weeks after my year 12 exams, while the rest of the guys were off partying in summer vacation, as you guys in the States would call it. We were at boot camp. So I was pretty lucky. I had a pretty good crew moving through basic training. In fact, a lot of the guys I trained with ended up in the special operations community eventually. And somewhere through that first 6 months of the training pipeline, I met what we call an underwater medic in Australia. And he'd been posted to the Special Air Service Regiment and deployed to Rwanda and was the first medic to receive the Medal for Gallantry in Australia. And I heard his story and I heard, I guess, his process and his life of being in the Special Air Service Regiment. And I hadn't really heard much of it before then. But I knew at that point in time that that's what I wanted to do. That sounded like the pinnacle. And so over the next 4 or 5 years, I worked towards it. You have to, in the Australian Army, you've got to work through your time and get the right experiences. As I met some of these senior medics from the special operations community, they sort of outlined a pathway to get there, which took about 4 or 5 years. That included infantry battalions. Like Tom, I also spent time in the special operations engineer regiment, but I was there for its birth in 2000, when it was initially stood up for the 2000 Olympics under the name of the Joint Incident Response Unit. So that was its very first year, and the first year the Australian Army had a dedicated counter-terrorist explosive and chemical warfare unit. So that was a pretty cool thing to be a part of. And the more I was exposed to these types of things, the more I knew that this is what I wanted to do. It seemed like it had real value compared to some of the other jobs in the Army. So I deployed with the infantry to places like East Timor, similarly to Tomo's wife, the humanitarian aid type things. And then after 5 years, got selected to do the underwater medics course, which for me, at that point in time, I was very lucky. There were so many medics who were incredibly capable, incredibly ready for that course. Only two people a year. Actually, my year was three people get selected to do the course. And so to be selected and to be given an opportunity was an incredible honor. And I worked with some of the most motivated medics that I've ever met on that course. We pushed each other to exceed. You know, we punished each other if we got below 95% in the exams, things like this. We wanted to be the best, and we wanted to come out of that course on top.
So just quickly, so the underwater medics, is that like a medic with like a dive capability?
Yeah, that's exactly it, John. We're specifically trained for diving operations, but also there's an intensive care element to it as well. So your level of invasive procedures goes up a little bit more, just due to your scope. So at that point in time in the Australian Army, it was, you know, one of the few courses where, or the only course really, where you could get to that level. I'm not so sure now. I've been out of it for about 9 years, but back then it was the course you wanted if you wanted to do those sorts of things. At the completion of the course, I was posted to SASR, which was the only unit at that point in time that required the skill set, and then and spent the next 6 years working in this unit with similar to Tomo, just the most motivated and committed people I've ever worked with. You know, it was a real honor and a privilege to work with the people that were there. That they were focused on the mission, focused on themselves, and everyone wanted to be the best and to do the best. So, you know, 6 years there was a great amount of time. I spent, like Tomo, deployed to Afghanistan, did a few counterterrorism roles, and then and eventually hit that point where, as a young sergeant, I was facing down the barrel of having to go back to real army for a while to do a training stint, and realized that wasn't the pipeline for me. So I discharged, made a bit of a plan, took about 12 months, and then discharged. I guess for me, the other point for me was my daughter was born. And the second my daughter was born, having lost a few mates and seen a few mates' kids without parents, I thought that, you know, that wasn't the future I wanted for my daughter. Even though I completely love the job and I still do, I think it's the best job I will have done and probably will ever do in my life. But that moment was there. I was ready to get out and move on.
Awesome. Okay. So I wanted to ask you guys separately, Tom, if we could start with you.
Sure.
If maybe you can share a story. I know that you were involved in the battle at Jabhat Khalay in Afghanistan. Yep. Now, I've seen this video of at least a portion of the fight. And I think it was used a couple of years ago, maybe in some kind of documentary. And I'd seen it online, and the part that I seen was it showed, like, I guess some operators moving behind a house and kind of getting into a fight, like a gunfight on the back end of the house, and then moving around and continuing to fight there. Can you explain that battle and your experience as you saw it?
Yeah, sure. So, we had some intelligence in that town. It was quite a far distance. So we used the helicopter package of four. So we had like a platoon minus that went that way, which is basically just, you know, not an entire platoon due to how many packs we could fit on the birds. So we took those birds and we went out just to sort of prod and prod around that intelligence that we had. And as we rounded sort of the last bend coming to the target, we started taking small arms fire in all the birds. So the LZs sort of all went out the window, and we sort of just got off where we could. And right from the start, there was contact, and you know, it was pretty hairy. We had four birds, so we had four teams in four different spots, all doing different things. One of the teams also had the Afghanistan local police force with them, you know, so they always came with us on the operations. So they were in one space, and then the three other Australian commando teams were in another space. You know, the planning was just to go out and see what we could see, but right from the start, like I said, it was fighting, you know, fighting for survival straight away. So, you know, that sort of plan to see if we could gather intelligence went out the window, and we just started to fight and sort of coordinate our teams. It came over the radio that we'd all, you know, immediately sustained a casualty. So, from the position I was in, our team had to move across quite a big open space. So we fought our way across to where our command element was, and then we fought from there towards the casualty. And at the same time, he'd taken a 7.62 round through his forearm, but with no exit. So it went and spiraled up his forearm into his elbow. And they were sort of fighting towards us. So, you know, we sort of met at a point, had some cover, and I sort of, you know, went straight to work. When I first saw him, he had already had one of his operator mates had already put on like a field dressing in the moment, but they were still firing, moving to get to our position. So when I got there, it was on, and it was absorbing some blood, but it wasn't, you know, heavily compressing the wound. So I sort of could just move it around, and I could see straight away that it was about, you know, 10 or 12 centimeter size wound just above the wrist. And so I went straight to work on that, getting, you know, an arterial tourniquet out, looping over his arm just to make sure that if it did start to bleed heavily or I, you know, needed to immediately put that on, and that was going to be in place ready for me to do so. sort of cut back his uniform so I could see if there was anything else going on, any shrapnel or anything else I wasn't aware about. A testament to his toughness, all he wanted to do was have a drink. He said he was dry in the mouth and, you know, he just wanted to have some water and sit down. I said, yeah, sure, no worries. You know, so I got someone to get him some water and I went to work. I just started packing his wound and, you know, using a dressing to cover that up. And as I was doing that we had a bit of security around us, we got word that we had another casualty. So I sort of did the best I could, made sure everything was sort of tidied up and then handed that casualty over to a combat first aider, which is, you know, an infantier with some point of injury care. So I gave that to him and he sort of took that back. Because of the level of fighting, we couldn't get an AME bird in, so we had one of our insertion Black Hawks turn around and come and pick him up. So that was lucky because we were about 40 minutes out from our original location. The footage, I suppose, that is used in the documentary is one of the best operators that I've ever worked with. And what happens is he heads up the hill towards one of the target compounds, and as he's rounding one of the corners, one of the insurgents starts to engage him from outside of a doorway. So he, you know, he fights and keeps that that insurgent suppressed in that doorway while we sort of got a plan together to see what we could see. But eventually we, you know, he stayed inside the compound and we sort of stayed outside the compound, and it was a bit of a to and fro for a while. So that's kind of what you can see in the footage there, is just the back and forth of what you know, the exchanges in and out of that doorway. And eventually what happened was they, you know, sort of made another plan and attacked the target from a different area in a different location.
Yeah, I think in the video at one point, I could be mistaken, but I think I remember seeing the guy kind of poke his head around the corner, or maybe that was outside of the door or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. He's got a bipod hanging up his weapon. Yeah, so that was, you know, a pretty intense day, and but you can tell, you know, from the audio of the footage that you know, there's some haste involved, but you know, testament to the guys, they're all calm and handle the situation quite well, considering, I thought.
And at the time that this fight took place, you guys were mainly doing direct action stuff, like going after like high value targets and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, so that was exactly what was that. There was a DA on a high value intelligence that day. You know, that was similar to, you know, the other operations that were going on at the time. Yeah.
Right. And what year was that?
2010.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I remember the first, I believe that same footage was used in the Voodoo Medics documentary, but I remember seeing it a few years ago in some other kind of Australian special forces like documentary, or maybe it was something that someone put together on YouTube. I don't remember, but,
sometimes when they do news pieces, they just grab, you know, whatever footage, you know, sort of suits the story at the time. Yeah.
Right. And it was footage from a helmet cam, right?
Yeah. So that's exactly right. From the side helmet cam. Yeah.
Okay. And have you treated civilians as well in Afghanistan or just Australians?
Oh, yeah, and most definitely civilians as well. So, I mean, a big part that makes it rewarding, and when people ask me about, you know, service and deployment and the treatment of injuries and casualties overseas, I always remind them that the biggest piece that or the most enjoyable piece, you know, one of the most enjoyable pieces over there is doing, you know, medical caps where, you know, you can go into a township and just, you know, I have a Bushmaster, a van full of medical capability, and just, you know, running, you know, like a little nurse's aid station or, you know, a medic's aid station and helping absolutely everybody that I can on the ground and, you know, with no contacts involved. And that's one of the most rewarding pieces, is having, you know, children who need glasses or antibiotics or just basic pain care and immobilization, all that sort of work comes into the piece as well. And it's a big part of what we did over there was, you know, a lot of first aid care on the ground, not tactically. Yeah.
Right. And I know, like, so I've had Dan Pronk on the podcast before. And yeah. Pronk is a doctor, and I know he was with the SASR. Did you guys also have doctors with you in the commando regiment, or was it just medics?
We definitely did, and a couple of times they would come out. The unique piece about Dan is he's, he's passed the SAS selection, so he, he can sort of run in both spaces at the same time. He can be used, as that combat doctor on the ground, but he's also quite capable within the tactical space as well. Whereas there's not a lot of those, getting right. around. So. We did have a doctor with us, but, only on small, outside the wire missions would they come, and then, they would just be on call should they be needed in other situations.
Okay, nice. And so I know, on the American side, an 18 Delta, a Special Forces medic, they are generally, at least on the American side, the highest trained medically, proficiency-wise.
Yeah.
And, they can do, some dental work. They can also do small kind of surgeries on the battlefield. And then, there's different levels. The other units will take half of the course, the medical course, like Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps. And then the senior medics from those other special operations units will go through the entire course that the Green Beret 18 Deltas go through. Yep. And they'll be on that kind of same level medically. Does such a thing exist in the Australian special operations world?
It's funny. I mean, I've worked closely with the ODA a couple of times with the 18 Deltas and some PJs and, lots of different forces, high-level sort of medical capabilities. And, we're very close to pushing in that direction. As far as field surgeries and that sort of thing go, not so much. But the capabilities of the special operations medics, on the ground interventions is quite high
right.
When compared to obviously your regular army, medics as well. So, I mean, so to answer your question, I suppose, having worked with some 18 Delta, some of the kit they have we don't have, and some of the kit we do have they don't have. So I guess it's sort of a bit of a chop and change about, right. Where the capability lies. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So Brad, when I received your bio from Christian, she emailed it to me. Next to your name is DSM. Does that stand for Distinguished Service Medal?
Yeah, it does, John. Yeah.
And is that something that you were awarded from a specific incident?
Yeah, it was an incident while I was deployed with the Special Air Service Regiment in Afghanistan.
Okay, is that something you can talk about or you feel comfortable talking about?
Yeah, look, it's something I can talk about, and I think more for the why. I think as a medic, you spend a lot of time deployed on these operations, and you have lots of losses, and you have lots of little, you're trying to validate your training and think, am I doing the right thing? And unfortunately, just due to the nature of the deployment, lots of people are injured, whether it's civilians, allied partners or your own guys, they get injured and some of them don't make it.
Right.
But for me, the jobs where they do make it or you get to use your skill set for good, similar to Tomo, for me, kicking indoors and running around with guns is fun. But my drive was to be that guy on the ground that could help someone when they really needed it. And I wanted to be that guy. So in 2006, while I was deployed with the Special Air Service Regiment, I had that opportunity. I had a few opportunities actually. But the one I guess that stands out for me was a really cool job that we were doing where we would jump on the pay forks, the US pay forks that came up to the Tarankout, and jump out on what we called voodoo retrieval missions. So we'd go out and do basic retrieval missions from either other FOBs or troops in contact at the time. So. For some reason in 2006, the PJ command weren't sending their PJs up into Tarankout or into the province. They were being held purely for downed aircraft. There was just this weird phase. It was frustrating them at the time. So we would jump on their payhawks when they came up, and they usually had an Air Force, some sort of random normal Air Force medic on it. So if we weren't out doing DAs or out on patrols, we would jump on these choppers. We were sitting in the command center one day, and a tick was in progress down in a town called Musakala.
Sorry, one second. So when you were then on these helicopters, you were working essentially as a medical QRF kind of, or
Yeah. So we would be we'd sit there as exactly as that, John, the medical QRF for the province, and we'd have an Apache gunship and a Payfork with its miniguns ready to go, so we nice. Could do a little bit better retrievals than dust off, I guess. So yeah, there was in the Helmand province next to us, there was a town called Musicalar, and they were in heavy contact. The British three para had just rolled into that town in 2006, and they were operating from there, and they weren't really successful in that year with their campaigns. But on this particular day, one of the Danish pathfinders attached to them had been shot in the head by a sniper, which initiated the contact as he was up on the compound wall. So he was in a pretty bad way. We were listening to the tick over the radio, and we were also listening to the Kazovac or the nine line come through. And initially, because of the province they were in and the troops that were in contact, it was a British nine line. So it went up through the British system, who were using Chinooks. They used Chinooks with a medical response team on them. But due to the compound and the area being in heavy contact, the British couldn't go in. They didn't commit. They wouldn't commit a helicopter. So next went to US Dustoff, who also declined at that point in time to go in. And we were sitting there listening to this thing, and our pilot, a captain, he said, you know, maybe we should go and have a look. So he reached out through Task Force Nighthawk and said we'd deploy and see if we could go out. But with the proviso that they would put the guy into an armored vehicle and bring him outside the town, and we'd meet them at an LZ to the north of the town. So we jumped, we spooled up, flew out to Musicalar. It was about 45 minutes. The problem for us was, being in Tarancat at the time, it was a long flight down to Musicalar, really hot conditions. So we didn't have much fuel time in the helicopter, so we wouldn't have much time on the ground when we got there. Anyway, we flew down and we hit the LZ and we hit the rendezvous point, but there was no one there. So we orbited it a couple of times, and we could see the town just to our south, and the pilot, you know, we're listening to this guy and we knew he was in a bad way. So the pilot asked if we wanted to go in, we'd just go for a quick spin past the compound and just see if we could land or if there was the potential to land. So we came in over the town pretty low, and as we came towards their compound, they popped smoke, and we could see there was a field again just to the, I think it was to the north of the compound. So the pilot indicated we're going to try and put in there pretty quick, because we'd started taking around, or they were having a crack at us at this point in time. And as we came in low and fast over the town, they'd forgotten to turn off the dizzy, which is the countermeasures on top of the helicopter. So I had this 1,200-degree ball of chafe just fire straight next to my head. And I initially thought we'd taken an RPG hit. And this ball just goes out and just, I don't know, rams straight into some person's compound. And anyway, we came in pretty hard, and the chopper hit the ground pretty hard. And anyway, after the dust settled, Dave, the Air Force medic, this guy, you know, this guy's straight out of basic training. He's not in the special operations community. Him and I disconnect and run to the back of the helicopter to go find this, go find an entry into this compound. And obviously they're still in contact at the other end. We could hear the contact go on as we moved away from the noise of the helicopter. But this British dude puts his head over the top and tells us about the casualty. And then we indicated we needed him to bring him out, and he declined. So we're standing there wasting time, and I'm looking along this wall. It was a good few hundred meters long, and I thought, oh, there's no door here. You know, there's no entry into this compound. And anyway, I look around and I see Dave's gone. He's back in the helicopter at this stage. And I thought, oh no, you know, I'm in a bad place here. So I ran back to the helicopter, plugged in, and spoke to the captain and said, look, you know, they're not here. And the compound looks like we're going to have to go look for it. And the captain said, well, you've got 10 minutes. So I can hold for 10 minutes, but that's it. So I grabbed Dave, and I realized that, you know, we're going to be fairly exposed as we move through the town. So I borrowed one of the door gunners, a guy named Carl. He, again, he's a door gunner on a chopper. He doesn't, I assume they do some sort of infantry minor tactics, but it's not his job. He grabbed a saw, you guys call it, and we jumped out and off we ran. So we ran around this compound into this eerie quiet, as you know, you could hear the contact going on in the distance, and obviously the noise, everyone's worked with Payforks or Blackhawks before, just that noise. And as we cleared the wall and got around the corner, it just went dead quiet. And, you know, just that eerie silence as we were running, trying to find an entry into this compound. Another couple of hundred meters and we got in, we found an entry and we found this Danish dude who'd been sedated in the back of an APC, in the back of a M113 in this compound, and they were working on him, and you could see instantly he was in a pretty bad way. He wasn't well, but he was at this point in time compensating. So I had a quick discussion with the Danish and the Brit dudes. Said, we've got to go, no time to muck around, let's just go. And they'd sedated him with a drug I'd never used before. So I was looking at this drug and I thought, oh, well, give me the Soldier's 5, how does it work? All right, cool, it's a normal anesthetic, I'll be okay. And we negotiated to get a couple of guys to help carry the stretcher because, you know, these guys didn't want to come out at that point in time. They wanted to continue supporting the fight, which was going on the other side of the compound. So anyway, we ran out and we carried this guy for, you know, we were just running with this heavy dude on a stretcher around the wall. And as we came back into the field where the pave hook was, about a dozen militia had formed up in a creek line and started having a crack. And we had about, I don't know, 80 meters to run across the open with this guy. So Carl jumped off the stretcher, drunk down, and just started laying down suppressive fire. And we just took off across the, you know, we had to go. If we didn't get him on the stretcher, you know, there was no doubt in my mind this guy wasn't going to make it. Sorry, if we didn't get him on the helicopter, he wasn't going to make it. So we just ran for it and got in the back of the helicopter, started cutting away cords, and Carl jumped in, got on the minigun, kept the suppressive fire, and away we went. And so we started flying. We weren't going to make our compound, or we needed to get him back to a Roll 2, to a proper hospital. We didn't have one in Tarancat at that point in time. So we started pushing for Kandahar. And so this guy, we started working on him in the back. His O2 sats were right down about 60%. He was going out the door, and I realized we need to intubate him and get a decent airway. So he'd had some sort of tube in there at the time. It wasn't working. So re-intubated in the back of the helicopter and got his O2 sats back up in the 90s, and he suddenly stabilized. And at that point in time, we just kept him sedated and got him to the hospital. So we worked on him for about 45 minutes. And as the chopper landed in Kandahar, we were on bingo fuel. He'd flown past his reserve, and he was shutting that thing down as soon as we landed. So we jumped in the back of a US Humvee and got dropped off at the hospital and handed over to the Canadians in the hospital there. And I guess as you know, as we walked away, covered in sweat, and had all these lovely nurses giving us bottles of water and cold towels, it was surreal. You know, it was a pretty cool feeling that we'd just handed over some guy. We didn't know his name; he would never know ours. But you know, we'd played a big part in keeping him alive and getting him home. So for me, that was probably the highlight of our trip. We, you know, I was awarded the Distinguished Service Medal in 2008. For leading the medical team on that day, and the pilot was charged for flying the helicopter to bingo fuel. So it didn't seem quite right to me. He copped a kick in the ass, and we were all given a pat on the back. But without a doubt, that guy, you know, making those decisions the day that he did, he deserves better recognition, if not bigger recognition than what we did. He was integral to that job. So yes, that was the DSM.
Nice. And the DSM, that was your first deployment into Afghanistan?
Yeah, my first and only deployment.
Okay.
into Afghanistan. And you know, for me, you know, 2 years later, this letter arrived in the mail, and this you know, offer to be awarded a DSM came, and I didn't really understand. I couldn't see what the point was. That was, you know, our job, and we'd done right. Exactly what any other medic and any other person. It didn't seem that special to me. It still doesn't, actually. It literally is just our job at the time, and anyone else in the same circumstances would do the same thing. But to have it awarded and to highlight the work that, you know, all those medics do. There's so many medics I've worked with, same as Tomo, who are, you know, silent, and they've done amazing things and never received the recognition. To have that, the group, I guess, highlighted a little bit more, that for me was a pretty special honor, and to be a part of that for everyone else was pretty cool.
And you were still in when you received the award?
Yeah, I was a sergeant at this point in time. Still, I was running the med training wing at SASR. And yes, I was still serving at that point in time. I'm still technically serving now. I'm a reservist now. Okay. Been out for 9 years, but I still love the Army and I'm still serving.
Okay, and so I also wanted to ask, and I guess for both of you guys, some of what I've seen, like I've had an 18 Delta on before, and he had a couple of rotations to Afghanistan, and specifically we were talking one time, and he was telling me about how they were in a gunfight, and then I guess they left that area, and then the next day they came back and there were like IEDs, and this one girl had stepped on an IED, and so they're trying to save her and he couldn't. And for some reason, I mean, not for some reason, but you know, for the reasons that it was a little girl, it was difficult for him to talk about it. And even though it's not an American, it's a young Afghani girl. And did you guys feel like, as medics, as special operations medics, that it was more difficult to treat children who were wounded out there?
Cool. Yeah, it always is. Nobody wants to see children injured. It just doesn't add up. So, yeah, of course. I think one of the things that helped me approach all treatment and how I operated within Afghanistan was I just – pre-deployment, I would put a lot of work into myself, you know, psychologically. And then when I was there, I would just focus on the signs and the symptoms and the injury and not the person. And that's how you can sort of get through it, is if you just focus on the life and doing what you can. And then, you know, from start to finish, that's kind of how I approached absolutely every single injury and casualty over there, and that way I didn't differentiate. I was always on, you know, using the top of my game for absolutely everything.
I think similar to Tomo, I think for every soldier, it doesn't matter how staunch or how tough you are, seeing kids injured and caught up in the middle of what we're doing over there, it's pretty hard on everyone. And it is unfortunately part of war. It always has been and always will be. You know, civilian populations are usually caught up, particularly with the nature of battles nowadays, and so you do have to deal with these. And as a medic, you know, it's our role predominantly to support our team, but you know, if we see a civilian, then of course we're going to render support to them as well. And if you see a kid, 100 all stops will usually be pulled out, doesn't matter what country they're from. I think at the time, similar to Tomo, you're clinical. Whilst you're on the ground, the mission is to save their life or to you know, decrease pain or to do something medical. The emotional side of it doesn't really have time to kick in at that point in time. You really have to do your job and get on with it. And, you know, there's plenty of jobs over there where, you know, terrible things happened. But in the moment, you don't really think about it. You just get on that, you know, you've been dealt a set of circumstances and these are the symptoms and the signs in front of me. I need to deal with them. And then you move on to the next set and then the next set. And so you don't really have time to really reflect on the moment. And you don't want that person on the ground. You don't want the medic on the ground to be breaking down and not able to help in that moment. And that's not to say we're robots and you can't be emotionally affected by it. Of course you are. But at the time on the ground, I think most of the guys, the way we train and the way we are perhaps inclined to operate, is you put that stuff to the side in that moment, and you get on with the job.
Yeah, I think Afghanistan specifically, it is the most mined country on the planet. With the Russians having been there in the 80s and fighting against the Taliban in the 80s, when they left a bunch of mines in Afghanistan, and they're now known as legacy mines. So then you have to deal with the mines left by the Russians and then the mines that are the IEDs left by the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and now ISIS in Afghanistan. So it's really dangerous for civilians and service members alike.
Yeah, look, I think particularly for the civilians, John, it's, you know, they live with this every day. Day one, we landed in Tarinkat about 10 o'clock at night, and at 7 o'clock the next morning, we went down at that point in time, we had a field surgical team from the US attached to our base. We went down to those guys and to introduce ourselves, and a guy was brought in 10 minutes later who had stood on a landmine during a feud with his neighbor. His neighbor was pissed off at him, so he went and got a mine, an anti-personnel mine, dug, dug it up and put it out the front of this guy's compound and called him out.
Wow.
And obviously as the guy came out, he's triggered the landmine. And, you know, these sorts of activities and this sort of feudal war confrontations between each other, it wasn't uncommon. It was every day. Every single day you'd see someone blown up or shot or stabbed, or it's commonplace.
Mm. Yeah, frustrating too. I remember having done a night reconnaissance walk, and then have a Bedouin camp come past our position the next day, walking exactly where we were. Between the time we'd returned from our reconnaissance to the time this Bedouin camp had come past the next day, it would have only been about 3 hours. But where we walked, they walked the next morning, and they set off two IEDs, which killed a couple of camels and a young local guy. And so we ran up there to respond, and he was well past saving. But I guess the most frustrating point is that, you know, no one wants to talk about anything. And in fact, the father of the young man that was killed that day, that was his third son that he'd lost. Wow. To IEDs. And he still wouldn't give any information or anything towards, helping the coalition in any way, which was frustrating.
I think the other thing for me too that was frustrating, and I know it frustrated a lot of us, was their willingness to use and to engage us with civilians in their vicinity. You know, if we were at home, we wouldn't pick a fight with anyone else. You know, if our families or our other families were in our vicinity, if we thought they could be hit with collateral damage. But, you know, these guys would have a crack at us from houses, and knowing full well the response that we would have to bring sometimes.
Yep.
I remember being in a fairly heavy contact. We were QRF for a US agency, and their Afghan Special Forces partners. They were hitting a high value target one night, and these guys were getting pumped from the helo insertion from the moment that thing landed. They initiate entry on the house and the compound, but intelligence was way under strength, and they were just pinned down. So we went in to help them this night about 1 o'clock in the morning, and we were ambushed on the way in. It took us a good hour to fight towards them, and we were pretty lucky that night. So we were able to get them out, but, you know, the whole night we had a C-130 gunship go Winchester above us. You know, it ran out of ammo. We were just in contact for about 3 or 4 hours. Just, you know, these guys, they had us. You know, we were in a pretty sketchy spot for a couple of moments there. Anyway, so long story short, we got out, and the next morning we'd got back to Tarankow. A couple of our vehicles had been disabled. A few of the Afghan SF had been killed, and a few guys injured. But we got back to the Tarankow and deserviced weapons, and sort of, you know, had breakfast and went to bed. And 20 minutes later, my boss came and got me and said, "Hey, you've got to come down to the FST. They've got mass casualty coming in." So rolled down there, and it was all these civilians who'd been caught up in this contact the night before, you know, and it was all these people that had been in houses, you know, dozens and dozens of people just really badly injured. And, you know, they'd obviously been caught up in our crossfire, and, you know, you think about this later. For me at the time, I was, like, you know, just angry at them that they would start a fight amongst these sort of people. And but also, you know, there's an acceptance that that's just the way it is there, and unfortunately that's the way they think and the way they operate. And for me, I guess all of the guys came home in one piece of sorts, but everyone came home that night, and we did the best we could to limit the damage to buildings. But, you know, it is frustrating to see these people getting injured occasionally as a byproduct of our battle, of our combat. So I find that probably even more frustrating than the IEDs and such. It's just the willingness to engage behind civilian population.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's a part of their strategy and their tactics is to do that. And one thing that kind of frustrates me is, at least on the American side, is, you know, I have people that I actually know, and a couple of years ago, I see them posting, like, on Facebook and social media, you know, talking about how I think specifically this incident was an American contact, and a bunch of civilians were killed. And I think the coalition forces, I don't think up to any point in history has a side in a fight gone to such great lengths to avoid casualties of civilians. I think typically war is like, we're just going to, you know, destroy everything we can in sight, and whoever is standing is standing. But I think now especially with Afghanistan and Iraq and other places, it's gotten to a point where, you know, there are certain rules. And don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating for civilians or people who aren't involved in the fighting to get killed. But I think the other side uses that as a tactic. And it just kind of frustrates me to see civilians from, you know, our allied nations kind of pointing the finger at our militaries and not saying anything about the other side. And there was a HBO documentary, I think it was in 2012 or 2010, when there was a surge. At the time, Barack Obama had ordered a surge of troops in Afghanistan. And it was a U.S. Marine element, and they were, I think it was in southern Afghanistan, I can't remember exactly, but they were pushing through these villages in a big push to retake some territory. And as they're fighting, you know, there's like a camera crew attached to them as they're fighting. They're getting shot at from like certain compounds, right? So then they wait a few minutes, and then you'll see like six or seven women and children come running out the compound. And then there's like one or two dudes mixed in between them. And you know, those are the guys who are shooting at them, but they can't shoot back because they're surrounded by civilians. And all of this is on the HBO documentary. And you can see and hear the frustration in the Marines' faces and voices. And I think had it been the other way around, like had the Taliban had the capabilities of, let's say in that fight, the U.S. Marines, they would have just destroyed everything and not even thought twice about it. And I think it's just something that people in the West take for granted when we're talking about, you know, how our militaries are fighting against this type of enemy, you know?
Yeah, man, you've got, you know, you've got 18 to 25 year olds in really stressful conditions and really hard moments, perhaps with their mates getting hit, having to make huge calls and huge decisions. And, you know, to show that restraint to not shoot at those guys is, you know, testament to those Marines on the day. And, you know, I guess we've got to take all we can do in these situations is take the moral high ground. And that's what separates us from them, right?
Right.
That we won't willingly engage non-combatants, whether they're women and children or others. So that's the only way we can deal with that is ideologically.
Right. So kind of switching back to the Voodoo Medics documentary, I wanted to ask you guys, you know, as you were doing it and then as it was finished, is it something that you watched with your families?
You get first, Tom.
You know, my wife being an ex-army medic as well, you know, she gets it, you know, so she, you know, everything that was going on with the explanation of all the guys, you know, she's got insight into as well. So I definitely watched it with her. I got two young boys. They haven't seen it yet. You know, I don't think they'd fully grasp the concept of it yet. So, you know, that'll be good for, you know, the legacy when they're a lot older, or, you know, when I can put things into context for them, I can show that that documentary. So the documentary, it's amazing and put together so well and humbling. So, yeah, I've sent it through to, my father's passed away now, but, you know, my mum's seen it, and, you know, a couple other members of the family that I know, you know, have a good understanding of what, you know, the service was like. Yeah, so definitely they've all watched it. You know, I'm definitely pro Voodoo Medics getting out there and being seen.
Yeah, I didn't watch it with my family. I guess I watched it by myself. I wanted to know what I've completed a media thing before, which I didn't really enjoy. But yeah, Kristen's done an amazing job in telling this story and yeah, had a lot of integrity and told the story exactly how she said she was going to, and with the message she said she was going to. So I live in a small country town in Australia, and I unfortunately my family aren't here with me, so I watched it by myself. But sent the link out and provided the link to all of my friends and family who, for, you know, 99% of them, this is the most I've ever talked about my military time. It was a chapter in my life that ended 9 years ago, and I loved it. And at the time, you know, didn't talk about it a lot, and now I don't really talk about it a lot. It's just a phase that I was in 9 years ago. So To be able to talk about it and talk about some of those, you know, more intense moments and I guess to get to where, to explain who I am and where I am today, I guess it was a really cool method of doing that, to talk about that chapter of life and the amazing people that I worked with. You know, these other voodoo medics and the operators that I worked with were, you know, people doing incredible things in highly stressful times. So yeah, it was good to get it out.
And so, Tom, I wanted to ask, and you know, sorry about your father passing away, but, you know, as an American who had moved out there, did he lose his accent? Like, did he end up with an Australian accent?
Yeah, no, never. You know, to a certain degree, he did. But there were certain things that I could never let him forget. his pronunciation. So he was he's from, you know, New California. He was from you know, that side of town. So that there would be specific things that every single time he would say them, I would repeat them to him to the point where he told me to shut up. you know, just because, you know, that's just how it was. And he stood out even after 30 years of him being here. You know, there were some things that he couldn't get right, like saying the word, like we say measure, mm-hmm. and he would say measure, and I would just pound him with that every day he'd say it. So he avoided using that word as much as he could, but yeah. There were some things he just couldn't get past. Yeah,
yeah, that's pretty interesting. I mean, and then of course, Australia was also involved in the Vietnam War. I think specifically the SAS, if I'm not mistaken.
No, we were fairly. We had infantry battalions there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pretty much every war you guys have been in for the last 100 years, we've been there. We like to come.
So and then Tom, if you don't mind me asking, how did your father end up going to Australia? Like, was it like a vacation and he decided he liked it? Or I mean, if you don't want to answer, that's fine.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So you know, because he was conscripted in 66, you know, so after his mandatory time was up, he got out, and his brother, like I said, he was conscripted at the same time. So they sort of, yeah, his brother ended up being a clerk. He went to paratroopers, so they had completely different careers within defense, but they both had their time being able to be finished up at the same time. So they both got out, and his brother stayed in the States. And I think my dad, he went straight into university or college, and he started studying business administration, and then he got a chance to have a year off, so he decided to come to Australia, and that's where he met my mum. And I think that, you know, they both moved back to the States for a while, but you know, he really fell in love with the country, so you know, he finished his studies, and then they moved out here. Yeah,
that's pretty awesome.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool. So so the Voodoo Medics documentary, I mean, I didn't know what to expect when I first saw it. And then Christian had sent me the link. I'd first seen, I think it was Dan Pronk and Mark Donaldson was sharing it on social media. That's kind of when I first became aware of it. And I didn't really know what to expect. Because like in the kind of realm of military kind of content creation, was audio or video, some of it is presented really well, and it kind of like touches deep, and some of it not so much, you know. So I wasn't sure what to expect, but then as I was watching it, I forget what episode it was, might have been 4, and then you just, I think it was actually Brad, I think, where like some you were telling a story, and I think some of the emotions were starting to kind of come to the surface. And once I saw that, I was like, wow, like this is like really capturing like the real deal, you know. And I think that's when it really hit me. I'm like, this is really done well. And it's not like some sugar-coated, you know, happy-go-lucky kind of thing. It's like, this is what these guys were really going through, and this is what, you know, they were really experiencing. And I think when you're talking about things that involve life and death, and being on that line so quite often as you are in a combat deployment, I think all of that stuff is very real, you know, for the human experience. And I think Christian did a great job in capturing that, and I think you guys did well in being honest and sharing your stories. And for anyone listening, I'm going to link for the documentary on the podcast notes and social media. So I highly recommend that you check it out, and you can see and hear from these guys directly. And not only from Tom and Brad, but there are several other medics, or kilos as they call them, in the documentary, sharing their different experiences in Afghanistan. And I think it's, like I said, it's really done incredibly well. And also, I want to thank you guys for doing this as well. You know, my audience is mainly American, but I know that people like to hear from, you know, our allied warriors as well.
Yeah, thanks for having us, John.
Yeah, thanks, John. I think, you know, that the fact that Voodoo Medics is getting out there internationally is terrific. And I just wanted to say that, you know, there's, I'm sitting here right now, I can think of, you know, 10, 12, 15 other Voodoo Medics that didn't, you know, actively contribute to the documentary, but that have actively, you know, contributed to the, you know, to the fraternity and the brotherhood that it is. And you know, especially when you compare, you know, specialists in the field, like, you know, if you speak about Grossman or you speak about Joe Kender in the police or, you know, law enforcement, it's good to have those sort of, you know, points of reference that you can have. And it's good to, that, you know, the Special Operations Medics of Australia, you know, have that voice.
So just quickly, if one of you guys can explain the name Voodoo Medics.
I think you did it well in the documentary, John. Sorry,
yeah. Tommy. Yeah. Oh, so it was Tom. You were the one who explained it in the actual documentary, right?
Yeah. So okay. The catchphrase being, you know, we'll do the voodoo so you can do what you do. I mean, you know, that's us, you know, basically just saying that we're really, really keen to do, you know, point of injury and battlefield medicine, and we're going to do that, and you can rely on that so you can focus on, you know, everything else, and we'll take that space up and you don't have to worry about it. Yeah.
Yeah, when I heard that, I was like, that's pretty cool, like the whole concept of it, just the name and everything like that, you know?
Yeah, the Voodoo Medics, and Jody sums it up quite well as well with the dark humor. I mean, Australians have got quite a sarcastic humor, and, you know, there's no shortage of that, you know, throughout the military as well. So, you know, it fits perfectly, I think.
You know, Australians are like some of the nicest people I've ever met. Like, I've like, in my, like, outside of this, the podcasting and stuff, I come across some Australians quite often in New York, and they're like the nicest people like you've ever meet. So it's just interesting to kind of see some of, or hear some of that dark humor, and, you know, from the combat veterans from Australia.
Yeah, I think the Americans that we worked with always found it very confronting when we'd be abusing our mates. they'd be confused when we'd say terrible things about our mates. But, you know, we if we said nice things, something would be wrong. So.
Yeah. All right, cool. So, again, I want to thank you guys for doing this. You know, I appreciate it. I know the audience is going to appreciate it. And thank you for your service as well.
Yeah, appreciate it. Hey, thanks for your time, John.
Yeah, thanks for having us, John.